Hi, my name's John Ingold.
I'm Saga Barushi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week we open to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book and interview one of the contributors about their chosen topic. So it's all about game narrative and the craft of writing. This week we're welcoming Darby McDevitt. Darby, hi.
Hi, how are you? It's good to be here.
We're good. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Perhaps we could start off, just tell the listeners, who are you? What have you done?
Well, I've been in the game industry about 26 years. I think I wrote or designed my first game when I was about 10, programming in BASIC on my parents' Apple IIc. And then right directly after college, I got a job as a writer-producer, kind of a strange hybrid, in a town just outside Seattle. So I'm from the Washington State area of the United States. My first job was in 1999, working for actually Ron Gilbert's company of Monkey Island fame. He had a company called Humongous that primarily focused on kids games. And so I was writing and producing and doing some like online QA testing, kind of a hodgepodge of things. And over the next about 11 years, I worked on all kinds of strange projects, mostly handheld games in the Seattle area. And one of those at the end of, let's say, 2008, 2009, was a couple Assassin's Creed handheld games commissioned by Ubisoft, but made by this company in Seattle. And the work I did there translated into Ubisoft being interested in me for one of their mainline Assassin's Creed games. So in 2010, or at the end of 2011, I moved to Montreal, where I am now. And I've been working on mostly Assassin's Creed as a lead writer, a narrative director, for the better part of 15 years, with a couple side adventures here and there. A good quarter century in games.
That's amazing. Like a proper journey through the games industry from first principles through to mainstream products.
And not just that, but a pretty front row seat to one of the biggest franchises that has existed over these last couple of decades. So we are excited to hear a little bit more about that. But our avenue in is going to be the article that you wrote for Kaleidoscope. The article is Flawless Victory and How to Avoid It. And I wonder, Darby, if you might be able to summarize a little bit of it for us here.
Yeah, the idea, I mean, I really thank John for actually inspiring me to actually sit down and write this, because I've been thinking about this for probably a decade. And it's something I put into practice when I was writing Black Flag specifically. But I like that when John sends out a call for things that are no longer than 1,000 words, I think I can actually do this. It won't take too long. I've had a decade to prepare. But the general idea is that I found over the many years that I've been writing for games, there's been a constant dissatisfaction in a very narrow space, which is the linear action adventure game. And I think it's very important to distinguish, because games are so broad and so diverse that it's really difficult to talk about, let's say, first principles with, you know, let's say comparing Tetris to King's Quest or something. So I'm kind of, my article is geared towards people who are working in these, let's say, cinematic, linear, narrative adventure space, where there's this kind of strange hybrid of storytelling and cinema and game, almost like a sport, where the mechanical affordances are fairly narrow. It's jumping and climbing and shooting and killing and things like that, and then fused with the idea of something that's quite familiar to us if you're into cinema and you go and you see cinematics and actors and all the kind of things that go along with that. The thing that I started getting frustrated with while writing these kinds of games 15 years ago was that it seemed to me that there was always this adage floating around that you should play the story, and that and that the mechanical inputs are somehow kind of these, they propel the drama forward. But that typically the stories that were being attached to games like this were ones where all of the mechanics that were available to the player were seen as, let's say, unambiguously good or unambiguously powerful and positive dynamics that pushed you forward. But then what that led to was this situation where the mechanical objective of a game, such as killing the final boss, and the narrative objective of the game, which was killing the final boss, or you know, getting your revenge against the final guy, these two things, these two simultaneous goals, were actually rubbing against each other in a way that actually made the drama almost impossible to achieve. Because when your objective is to actually beat the game, you aren't actually engaging with the vagaries of what real drama can bring you, which is having no idea what the outcome is, and watching characters move through spaces without a guaranteed outcome. So, God, I hope I described that correctly, but that's basically the idea. So the title is a cheeky play on Mortal Kombat, but which doesn't really fit into the kind of game I'm talking about. But the idea is that the premise behind my article is simply that, what if you took the gameplay mechanics and you treated them as the worst aspects of your character, or let's say the most selfish? And I think my favorite line in the article is something like how easy it would be to make a game about a poker player or a Balatro player who's ruining his social life by being really good at Balatro or poker, right? And so rather than, because you could imagine, for instance, let's say Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, where the story is about beating Mike Tyson and, you know, he's at the end of the thing. Of course you're going to beat Mike Tyson because that's the challenge the game put in front of you. But if you were a boxer who had to go home to his wife and kids every day and you were ruining their life with your obsession with boxing, that's actually kind of interesting. Now, I don't know who would make that game, but I'd like to see it.
Well, no, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because you're talking about essentially that we lose suspense a lot of times in games because... Yeah. It's on the box what you're going to do, right? And you reference all these games that subvert that in the way that you've suggested, right? Papers, Please, or Red Dead Redemption, or your own game, Black Flag, right? And how you thought about this very explicitly and sort of tried to manage that. And it sounds like that's been on your mind for a while, right?
Yeah, some people will often ask me, like, who's the, for those of you who've played Black Flag, like, who's the villain? Is it Torres the Templar or is it Black Bart Roberts? And I always say, it's Edward Kenway. It's the main character. It's the guy you're playing. And the longer you want to be a pirate, the more you do piratey things. And the game explicitly sets out at the beginning that he wants something else. But the player, especially when you first start playing, you're like, I bought a pirate game. I don't want to go home. So I set that up as like, you know, I don't want to be cheeky about it, but I do think in some sense that you're playing the villain in it, which I think is interesting. I always talk about Shadow of the Colossus as being the version of this, or that game is exactly what I'm talking about and nothing else. It has like one example of everything. And that's it. There's like, what, four dramatic turns and through the whole game. And it's literally just setting up a plot and a mechanical objective. Then a little while ways into it, suggesting that achieving that objective might actually lead to worse things. And then seeing how that plays out. And it does a really good job of just pushing you forward with this feeling of dread that things aren't going to turn out well. But always with the mind that like, well, at least... I've only got five more Colossi, and I got to do that. It'd probably be a failure as a game if it was like, you know, I got to put this down now because I don't want to see what happens.
So I think I loved your article. I thought it was really, really interesting, and it was amazing to read kind of that insight into the thought process behind Black Flag. I have another question I really want to ask, but I was going to ask this first because it's directly related to Black Flag. So Black Flag is one of the few games that I finished, because games are massive these days, and it's one of the few game endings that genuinely made me cry. Like, I think I cried at the end of Ico, and I cried at the end of Black Flag. And the funny thing about it is that when I'm telling people about the story of Black Flag, it still kind of makes me tear up just describing it, but I don't really know why. I don't know quite what it is about it that landed the emotional impact for me, because when you describe it to people, they're like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. There's the guy, and then he goes home again. But I'm like, no, but that's not it. There's something deeper there. And basically, now that I have you on the hook and, like, you know, on the end of a microphone, I wondered if you had any insight as to why the ending of Black Flag lands. Like, is it because of this, like, using the main character against himself, or is it something else, or is it something about the kind of, I don't know if you have any theories.
Yeah, I,
like,
don't.
I'd really like to know.
I don't
Why
know.
Why does it work as well as it does?
I have no idea. I mean, there were a few things I was pretty conscious of while writing it. And that was back in the day, too, where the games were small enough at that time where it could have one writer for the main story, which was me. And then I had a great writer, Jill Murray, who also has I think, an essay in your book. She wrote all the side content, and that was basically just the two of us for that whole game. But while I was writing it, I was really just conscious of trying to keep objectives as simple as possible throughout. You know, whatever his motivation was, fairly simple. It gets a little muddled sometimes, but specifically so that the characters could just pop and live and be differentiated and be interesting and have each one have their own objective. Obviously, the difficult thing about writing a game is, and working with actors who play our leads, they notice this all the time. We always say, you're starring in a movie in which you are in every single scene. And not only are you in every single scene, but you're in every single bit of downtime as well. Like, you know, in a movie that would, you know, like, that would cut from, like, guy getting into a car and then appearing at the United Nations and getting out and jumping in, going into the building. Well, you're going to be in all the part where you travel to the United Nations building, too. And then you might have thoughts that pop in your head. So you really, the structure of a game like this is that you have to sustain an interest in this character for a long time. And that means objectives have to be simple and clear. What people want have to be simple and clear. But it's very easy to slip into all these other characters in the game. They exist to serve me because you know, I can, oh, that's the guy that repairs my guns, and so he's the quirky gun guy, and that person is the medic, so that they have a quirky medic background, and I only relate to them because I want something from them mechanically. And I tried very hard to make sure that there was a cast of characters that every time you met them, you could see where they were at in their little journey. Maybe the structure of the game helps that, because pirates are just always crisscrossing, and you know, they're not always hanging out around a single office, pounding desks and going, "What do we do next?" You're passing them in the night sometimes, or running into them in strange places, and so it was always fun to just. It's this guy, Steve Bonnet, or it's this guy, Blackbeard. Let's see what they're doing, and
enough time could have passed that things would have changed for them
as well.
You can keep, it's always fresh, right? Every time you check in with them.
Yeah, I would love to know, I would just love to hear John talk more about why he liked it, because it's a long time ago and I remember being very driven, and you know, I wrote a lot of it, like I would write a lot of it on paper at a bar next to my house, or I would get in the habit of writing scenes in my head while I did a 25-minute walk to work, and then I would just transcribe what I was thinking about. And it kind of came together that way, but I do remember writing some of the ending scenes. I do remember getting pretty sad myself, writing these at my kitchen table. And the idea to end it with the parting glass, that song, I guess that song had been used elsewhere around the same time, but I just knew that as a song from, like, I'd loved Irish music for a long, long time, and I went to school in Ireland, and So that was just a song that I knew for a long time, and so I added it. Mm. But I think the woman who played Anne Bonny, Sarah Green, she's from Cork, and so when she came into the studio, I was like, "Do you know the Parting Glass?" She's just like, "Of course I do."
Yeah, I think for me, like, it's really interesting to hear you describe it the way that you have, because I think the reality of the characters is a big part of what made that ending work. So if for people who haven't finished it, at the very end, Edward Kenway goes home and he leaves the other pirates that he's kind of worked with and collaborated with and somewhat nurtured, but also been nurtured by, to sort of carry on what they're doing. They carry on pirating away. And I think it's partly that I believed in them as people who were going to go off and have their own lives that I wouldn't see as the player. So I was genuinely saying goodbye to some people who were real. I think the other thing that really worked for me was the sense of the time, like this, that there was this joyful kind of free, ruleless time that Kenway has in his life. And then he gives it up for something more important. And that, I think, probably is the thing that spoke to me, which I think relates to the Flawless Victory article, really. It's this sort of this sense that there's something you've held back as a writer for this character to do. And actually, as the game goes on, the thing that they're not doing is more important than the thing that they're doing, which is kind of, I know Saga wanted to jump in with a question as well, but I just have to follow this up with one more question, which is, and I think you've answered it actually, but I just wanted to say, how do you get away with that in a studio context? How do you manage to hold something back for the main character of a game across 100 hours in a AAA environment? I just think that's extraordinary.
I don't know.
Fair enough.
I think I'm a pretty nostalgic person, and I think sometimes I have this sense that, you know, because I moved from Seattle and I left behind a lot of people that I loved. I worked in the music scene there. I worked in the theater scene, as well as games and writing. And I left people behind. And I still, to this day, after 15 years of being gone, I have this sense of like, oh, like I could go back and just pick up where I left off. And of course, that's not true. If I actually go and look at Facebook, I'm like, oh, that person looks older. Yeah, that'll 15 years will do that. I think I was trying to like really hammer on that feeling where Edward, he goes at the beginning of the game, he says like, I'll go for 2 years as a privateer, which was fairly common at the time. Like some people think, oh, Edward's kind of an asshole because he left his wife. And it was like, but that was very, very common to like leave your family to go, you know, and that's a story to this day, like migrants who will move, you know, halfway across the world to try to make something, send some money back, and with the eventual hope of being reconnected. And so I think that there's that sense, like people are like, what is he doing? But then it's clear, it says like 4 years later, like, cause there's a line that says, promise me 2 years, don't go any more than 2 years. And he's like, yeah. And then you're like 4 years later.
And the juxtaposition really works there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And then 5 years and then 6 years. And I think he's gone a total of 7 years. But he's always throughout the game writing a letter and sending it or crumpling it up. Like, no, she's probably left me already. And like, no, this idea that he can just go back when the time is right. But of course, that's not true, and it turns out to only be partially true at the end of the game.
I think that's right, right? Like the structure of the story that you were trying to tell lent itself really nicely to that type of ending. That being said, your article has a certain universality about it, right? Like it has a certain sense that like, well, this is, and by the way, I agree, this is the sort of thing we can do with a wide variety of stories, right? Not only ones where the main character goes on a quest away from a sort of place of stability, leaves the Shire and then does something and then comes back, right? You know, at my studio, we think about this quite a bit, actually, because we like to tell character-driven narrative. It's really important that we typically have named clear protagonists with backstories that where to some degree the things you're doing in the game get subverted by the end. But it has occurred to me that this requires the end, Act Three, let's say, to do a lot of work. A lot more work than in most other media, right? Like in games, we have these really extended act twos where you're doing this sort of slow growth, you're meeting your sort of crew, you're increasing in ability, and that's like 90%+ of the game, right? That wouldn't be true in cinema. And the trouble is, The trouble is it's such a hard challenge to at the end convey all the revelations that are necessary and still keep the player with you, right? Still make them feel like, oh yeah, that's still the character that I've known all along. That's still the same John Marsden that I've been with, you know, this whole way through. And I think that's really hard to do, right? Because you have such an economy of time at the end. And who knows how many players are even getting to that point, right? So yeah, I just don't know how do you plan for it in such a way that the flaw can be revealed without it subverting the character in that kind of tight window you have right there at the end of the game.
It really takes a lot of thinking about making sure that I call it like making sure that there's tangential conflicts, right, rather than parallel conflicts. Like I use this a lot. My colleagues and friends always tell me to shut up and just make this game, but I can't because I need bazillions of dollars. But I always use a firefighting as an example. There's a great board game called Flashpoint, which is just a really fun.
Oh yeah, I know
really,
it very well.
Yeah, a brilliantly themed game. Every mechanic just gets you really into, like, there's a fire propagation mechanic, and there's how much you can carry and how many moves. And I always say, like, I use this example, like, if I were to make a multiplayer firefighting game or just a single-player firefighting game, the only way to get a good story would be to, would be to make the core conflict not about firefighting. Because firefighting is something that you're going to get better at. I mean, mechanically, you're going to get better at it. You're going to be able to move the controller better. You're going to excel at that. You're also probably going to put, you know, firefighter points into your, you know, strength and agility and acuteness or whatever. You're going to get new, cool, like, firefighting grenades that explode and send all kinds of white dust everywhere. All that, typically games are all about a kind of a progression that just goes up like that. So how do you get any drama out of that? And it goes back to, like, I think 20 years ago, if you'd asked me to make this game, I would have been like, okay, and the main story is there's an arsonist running around. Yeah. He's setting fires willy-nilly. Yeah. And you go in and you put out a fire and then you investigate and you go, ah, and then sometimes you see him up in the third story window and you're like, ah, fucking arsonist. But I was like, nah, because...
And the twist is the arsonist is your brother, obviously. And that's
or it's you somehow and the game didn't tell you that.
Right, exactly.
But to me, it goes back to again, like, you know, it sounds like I have problems with happy families. But again, like, if you made the story about if the drama was actually between the people in your precinct, and the drama was about all the friends who go on the missions with you, that's essentially what Black Flag is, right? You could levy some criticism at Black Flag that it doesn't have great villains, you know, the Templar and the baddie pirate. But I like Black Bart Roberts, I'll say. But really, the drama and the heart wrenching material, I think, is the slow dissolution of this group of friends, these pirates that all believed in one thing at the beginning and are all completely torn apart at the end. That to me is the interesting part. And so, a firefighter game where you're at odds with and the kind of the thing you're trying to solve is something that's within your own precinct, or maybe your family, you know, you never come home at night, you know, a typical thing. Like, I think of John Cassavetes, A Woman Under the Influence. There's at the very beginning of the movie, the wife, Jenna Rollins, is staying up waiting for Peter Falk to come home. And then he calls her up and he's like working on a night shift on like if there's a burst pipe. He's like, I'm sorry, honey, I can't come home tonight. I'm going to be all here all night. And she's like, and she goes to a bar and gets drunk and just hits on somebody else. Right. Like, that's the kind of drama at home. The game part would be the guy that's fixing the pipe. That's the game.
Yeah.
But then you come home to some other drama that's tangential to that. And I think that's really interesting. I think this does mean that you need to allocate a certain amount of resources to that other thing, which would be maybe easy to cut, right? Like, nah, just go with the arsonist because we got all that stuff. But you have to plan ahead and you have to think hard about what is the... By doing the game by playing the game and gaining these things, what is it that I stand to lose in some other aspect of my life? I mean, it's not zero sum, but it's, you know, there's trade-offs.
Yeah, because otherwise we're just telling a story about someone getting better and better and better at everything, which has nowhere it can go. Yeah, that makes total sense.
And I like the way you said this, right? Because you've helped me understand something, because it's the idea of tangential conflicts can work really well here. So it doesn't have to be that the abilities, the core verbs that the player is doing, are at odds directly with their sort of true flaw. It could be that it just is a distraction, right? It's just this other thing that they're doing to help them ignore this other issue, or that other problem grows and grows until it gets to the end. So it's not like your work to become a better firefighter is bad. It's just the player isn't punished for becoming a better firefighter. They are simply told there was an opportunity cost.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because, yeah, if you go too far, you run the risk of, A, I don't like this person that I'm playing. It doesn't get as far as the, what's the Romero game? Train, right? Like, which is just like, as soon as you play that and you realize what's happening, you're like, no, thank you. you don't want to go that far unless you're making a work of art that's making a point. So, exactly.
I guess I'm really interested by this kind of concept of how far you can push this flawed protagonist, because, while you were describing your firefighter game, one of the thoughts that popped into my head was, okay, what if, just randomly, what if your firefighter gets, you know, very traumatized by what he's seen and what he's had to do, and he starts drinking and he ends up as an alcoholic. And so you have a classic kind of all-American narrative about there's a hero guy, but he struggles with booze. That's a story Americans love to tell. Can you make that work in a game? Because inevitably, people would say, so you have a character who gets better and better at firefighting, but presumably he's sort of a bit of a physical wreck because of his drinking, and perhaps his vision goes blurry. And actually, wait, no, this sounds incredibly annoying. Because, like, as a player in Act 3, I don't really want my vision going blurry because my character's been drinking. That sounds pretty frustrating. And I guess I was thinking, is that a solvable problem? Can we actually make games where the protagonist gets impeded as they go along, where they get injured or they end up in a wheelchair and it's fundamental to the gameplay? Or is that just is that kind of storytelling just off the table for us as a medium?
I mean, games don't have to be fun as long as they're interesting, I suppose. But that might not be where you sell bazillions of copies. I always did have this idea that it would be fun to have a game where, let's say, you started with some sort of collection of 8 sort of affordances and abilities and things. And as you leveled up, you had to swap one out. And when you swapped it out, it was gone forever. And you just keep doing that and keep doing that and keep doing that, so that the thing you were at the end bore little resemblance to the thing you were at the beginning. I don't know if that's not exactly what you're talking about. The subject of alcohol is really interesting, because on Black Flag, I actually pitched this idea that I don't think would have made the game more fun, but perhaps more interesting. It occurred to me that alcohol is typically not done very realistically in games, although I'm sure there's examples, so, you know, feel free to leave a comment below. The interesting way of doing alcohol would be that you're in a situation and you take a drink and it gives you some sort of boost that's very, very, very appealing. And after a while, you go like, and then it wears off. And you're like, okay, that's interesting. And then so when you get in that situation again, you're like, well, I'm doing that again. And then I'm doing that again. But then there's a tail. There starts to be a tail where now you get the blurry vision. And you're like, well, it's only 30 seconds of blurry vision. I can handle that. And then you get into another boss fight and you're like, I got to drink that drink again because it gives me super strength. And that tail very quickly gets really long. And now what you have to do is you have to progress forward a certain amount. And if you want to get clean, you have to forego alcohol entirely. But you're now so used to the bonus that the x5 damage bonus that it gives you, that you're like, now I have to learn to play this game for real. Something like that would be a closer approximation of how alcohol or some sort of addiction works in a person's life. Mm. Rather than this kind of silly, like, I drink, I'm immediately blurry, it's annoying for 2 minutes, it wears off. Which is the sort of the, I guess, GTA 4
although
version.
That was my experience of drinking alcoholic lemonade when I was a 16-year-old. We would just get very silly for about 10 minutes and then go, why are we in this bus stop? But whatever, that was just my childhood. I had another question which is related to that, which is, obviously you said at the start that your article was thinking very much about linear action adventures. So there isn't much room for player choice. And I guess I'm interested in, you know, can we make this kind of character-based stuff work? Can we work with choice? Like, should we give Edward Kenway a choice at the end of Black Flag, or is that simply never going to be interesting? Like, do we lose something there, or is that the right play?
I don't know. This comes up a lot in every game I've worked on, you know, because Assassin's Creed started out as very linear, and the only choice in, like, Assassin's Creed 2 was whether or not to hug Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah, and, I remember.
and, you know, people who, like, missed it were like, okay, uninstalling or reloading that and doing that again. There is an interesting thing, because then Assassin's Creed dipped into the choice thing for a while, and some games now have had it. Shadows had it, Mirage did not, or more recently. There is a kind of there's as many opinions on the floor about what a game ought to be as there are people making it. There are people, you know, that will say, like, oh, let's in this one place, let's give the player a choice. And I guess for me, it's always, I always like to sort of just know the game I'm making and stay within it. Certainly, and not kind of, yeah, like I said, make a hodgepodge of, like, oh, a couple different ideas. I would not give Edward a choice simply because I think maybe my thought would be, like, we're never going to be, like, as good as an Inkle game, so why even bother? Like, you know, it's like I have all kinds of questions for you, but maybe that's on my podcast. But it's like, what you do feels like a world apart from what I've been doing, and I hesitate to even call them the same medium or mode or whatever, just because they're both digital and on a screen. I'm hugely impressed by, you know, I think I've told you before, but I like 80 Days was my first foray into Inkle games, and I was just blown away by the like branching paths, like some crazy lichen moving over a cliffside. It's so different than what I have been doing, and I kind of feel like when we decide what we are doing, it's a linear game, that I want to stay in that space and solve those problems. So I'm sure you could give Edward a choice.
I don't know that I'd even want to. Like, 80 Days is interesting, right? Because obviously it's a choice-based game, but you know what? You never get the choice to go around the world the other way, and you never get the choice to just sit in your cellar in London and pretend that you've been around the world and then pop up after 40 days. Like, in that sense, the game is constrained in the same way that Black Flag is constrained, and that you will follow this linear path of making a journey. It's just the specifics of the journey will be kind of decided by what you do. So I think we're always in conversation between where are the freedoms and where are the rails, and how do we make sure that players, I guess, understand where the rails are so they don't get too annoyed about it, basically.
Yeah.
Like, if you offer someone something that looks like it's going to be a choice and then isn't, that's frustrating. But
yeah, it's the annoyance, actually, that's the key point, right? Because by conveying a little mechanic, even if it's in a really small place, you've built up some expectation that it's a Chekhov's gun or something, right? There's going to be some other version of it, or it's going to get twisted, or there's going to be more of this. And if in fact there isn't that much more, I think that's probably a good candidate to cut.
In Uncharted 4, they added some dialogue choices, and they put them in one of the trailers or the previews, and I was like, oh crap, Naughty Dog are doing branching narrative. Like, this is serious. And then in the game, they're totally throwaway moments. They're just like, which anecdote do you want to relate to this character, A, B, or C? And you choose one, and then it moves on, and then it's gone. And I have no idea whether that's because they were experimenting with it as a mechanic or they wanted to do more and then they pulled it back, but it feels very out of their lane in some ways.
It didn't
feature in the end of the game at all.
Yeah, that would be my fear is going halfway and then kind of just kind of stopping short of an actually like interesting idea.
It does make me think a little bit about genre choice, and not narrative genre, not like sort of mystery or comedy or whatever, but game genre, right? Like the type of game that we're making and how we're communicating that to players. And it just strikes me that you have a particularly unusual perch to see this because you've been with an IP over a long period of time, and you've had certain challenges, I would imagine, with that. I suppose most people, when they're making a game, they hope that it can become a bigger thing and that it can continue, but they don't know, right? They may not know at the beginning. And that may be very true for Ubisoft as well, that it's not like you've greenlit three games all in a row. Maybe it's one at a time, or you're testing a mechanic and this one will be a bit more RPG-like and this one will be a little bit closer to Altair, you know, and his experience. And I wonder, just to bring us back to this discussion about the character flaw and it conveying, we've typically talked about examples where we have a lot of control, right? Like you are one of two writers in one contiguous game, but you also have characters in the meta plot that continue, right? So Layla or even Basim, I suppose, right? In certain ways. But when you're planning an arc like this, and especially if you don't even know exactly what type of game genre the next game is going to be or the one after that is going to be, how do you do that? Do you keep it relatively hands off so that you can guarantee a couple beats are hit, or do you try for something a bit more ambitious? I mean, right. I don't even know how you would think about that problem.
This is where all the Assassin's Creed fans, they put their ear to the mic, like, what's he gonna say? to be honest, I mean, it's a big game series. It's made by multiple studios, Ubisoft studios around the world. We really just have to take the approach of, you know, like I listened to an interview with Vince Gilligan a little while ago, Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, and mm-hmm. Pluribus. It's every season for him is its own thing, and he tries to end somewhere with a good question, but he doesn't know what's going to happen in the next season. And they have ideas they like to explore and things like that, but because having somebody at the head kind of directing like some kind of like meta showrunner would actually just really, it would be difficult for individual teams to make their own creative choices and things. So a lot of our choices down to the team level, right? Where when I am working on a game, I try to make that one game as good as possible, considering all that has come before as well. Taking it somewhere, putting it somewhere interesting, consulting with other teams, certainly teams that have made the previous game and that will make the next game. There's a lot of collaboration across studios, but my focus is, I'd say 95% of it is always, let's make this one game the best it can possibly be. It reached a point too where, like, my experience working on I Wrote Revelations as well, which was which was very odd because it was the third Ezio game, but the fourth Desmond game out of five. So
right,
when you play right, yeah. Revelations, you're seeing part three of one guy's story and part four of another guy's story, and that was hard to sort of manage like as a single game, right? We always want someone. This could be their first Assassin's Creed game, and so with Black Flag, I was able to do that a lot better, I think, where Edward's story is pretty complete, but also the modern day story in it has a five act structure that has a beginning, middle, and end with actual conflicts, and there's actually only five parts, so each one part is one act. And it was designed that way, and it's even designed in a way where when the character in the modern day is thrown in jail, a jail kind of, so is Edward. So there's a parody there. So I really tried to make it so that Black Flag as a story experience stood alone, even though it had obviously the weight of all kinds of previous games. Yeah,
I love it. It's kind of It's kind of the model that they wanted to do with the modern day Star Wars films, but they didn't really manage to do a very good job of it. So like, it's nice to see that some people have been managing to do this quite successfully, just kind of handing the lore off to the next people in an interesting way. I had one other question, which I thought was, which is interesting to me, that going way back to the original description of the article, and you were talking about giving the protagonist something dramatic that can happen, basically something that can go wrong for them, essentially a kind of narrative risk. And I was thinking, one of the things about the linear action adventure story that I've always found to be a really deep contradiction in the storytelling of it is that it's supposed to be a story about, it's like a Die Hard story or something like that. It's a story about an action hero who gets away in the nick of time and just about manages. So he has no room for failure whatsoever. Like, he cannot get killed. He cannot really get harmed. He can't be stopped. That's core to the genre. That's the promise of the genre, is that we will be with this guy from beginning to end. But that carries with it this sense that the narrative can't afford to take many risks, and it can't afford to put things on the line, because that's breaking the kind of core contract of the game. So I was just sort of wondering, how do we as designers, more as narrative designers, how can we sort of expand that space? Like, what strategies have we got for expanding the space so that we don't just start a game and immediately know, okay, this is exactly what's going to happen. He's going to kill this guy, kill that guy, kill that guy, and that'll be the end. Like, where are the things we can pull apart without breaking that core fantasy of being someone who is ultimately going to win?
I borrow a lot from, I don't know, if you consider yourself a script writer or a writer, but if you've read, you know, the usual kind of thing you're supposed to absorb as a screenwriter is McKee's storybook, you know, down all the kind of principles of screenwriting, screenplay writing. One of the concepts that I actually find really helpful that he has, that I translate into games a lot, is this notion of the obligatory scene. The idea of an obligatory scene is, what is that one scene when you first start watching a movie, within, say, the first 10 minutes, that the viewer says, okay, when I see this happen, when I see X happen, this story is over. And of course, a good writer will never give you X, but you will always move forward expecting X. An obvious example would be like The Lord of the Rings, where it's like, hey, what's this ring? And then, like, within the first, you know, hour and a half of Fellowship, he's like, throw this in Mount Doom. And at that point, the entire audience goes, okay, when I see this ring tumble into the fires of Mount Doom, this movie's over, probably.
There'll be another half hour on the end. But, exactly.
Yeah, but I think that's a very useful concept, because in games, if you can put in a concept in the player's head of what may happen, that has an actual question mark attached to it. Like, because, and this is why I use the example of Ganon and Link, right? At the very, very beginning of, let's say, Breath of the Wild, you know, or take any Zelda game, right? It's, oh, Ganon's back, and he's doing all kinds of stuff, and kill him, and then the world will be better. And so the obligatory scene is, okay, Ganon, if he dies, then the world will be better. That's the scene that shows that this game is going to be over. But that's also like when you look at, oh, I've got three hearts, and I've got one circle of stamina, and okay, in order to mechanically kill Ganon, I'm going to have to do all this stuff, and it's going to linearly rise. This obligatory scene is something you're expecting in the gameplay as well. And that is just deeply uninteresting, I think, in the long term. So for me, I think the strategy is, in the very beginning, set up a question for this character that cannot be answered through any of the gameplay you're going to do. That way, you're going to question whether it actually ever happens or not. So, for instance, in Black Flag, it's is he going to see his wife again? Is he going to get to go back home the way he thinks he will? You can't pirate your way back into her heart. That's, you know, same thing with Red Dead. It's the question at the beginning is, you want to see your wife and kids again? Then you go kill these three guys. And he's like, okay. And you, from the beginning, you go like, okay, well, if I do that, I'll see my wife again. But I cannot directly achieve, I can't go to where my wife and kids are, break down the door. Sorry, I'm just kicking things in. Break down the door and shoot everybody in the room and rescue my kids. That is just not how that story is constructed.
You literally and can't so, access that part of the map for much exactly. of the game, right?
Like it's yeah, yeah. So, so I think that that for me is work really hard when you're thinking about your story. Put a question in the player's mind that you set it up where they really want this question answered. They want to see this scene. They want to see it more than anything. But they also understand that I can't play my way to that scene by just moving forward. The scene's not going to just magically appear to me on a platter. That's why, like, when I bring up Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, right? The obligatory scene is, well, I punch Mike Tyson in the face and he goes down, okay? And that's all you're working towards through the whole game. And if the game, at the end of it, Mike Tyson pulled out a gun and shot you, you'd be like, hey, that's kind of breaking the contract that we've had all the way up to here. I don't know if that makes sense.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. Yeah, that's a really great answer. Well, we've talked for 45 minutes. I think we could probably talk for multiple hours more. Hopefully in the future we will. But for now, let's wrap that up there. Thank you so much for joining us, Darby. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great being here. Thank you so much.